This morning at the morning teaching, there was a question came up around kusala, akusala, kusala meaning wholesome mind, kusala jitta, the wholesome mind. And so I kind of, one just sort of was rolling around in my mind today when I was practicing. I started to look up a few things because I wasn't able to give a clear answer this morning. And I don't think I actually resolved the actual question yet either, but it was just sort of nice reflecting on those aspects of what is, say, what is good, what is wholesome, what is skillful. Those are the word kusala is the word that is used by the Buddha to denote, say, that which is good or skillful or wholesome. And none of those are actually very accurate translations. The Buddha's delineation of these concepts doesn't really fall into the kind of black and white, good and evil, right and wrong type of characteristic that the Western English language has sort of constellated. And so it's an interesting theme to be considering. One, because it's so different from our moralistic way of considering things. And it was like last night where I was watching a DVD. It's about a Thai nun. Actually came and visited and offered it. And it's actually tomorrow. It was entered in the Santa Barbara Film Festival, and it'll be there's been a couple showings this week, and it's been very well received. But there was one particular scene where she's talking to the film director is talking to a young woman who is recounting her meeting with this nun, Meiji Sansoni. And saying that she first started asking her questions because she was, at that point, she was about 14, and at the time of the film, she's still probably only, I don't know, 16, 17, maybe 18. And she was having a lot of conflict with her mother. And the girl was talking in terms of right and wrong, and that sense of conflict that my mother's wrong, I'm right. And she, I think she's grown up grown up mostly in Denmark. She'd only recently come back to Thailand. They'd recently moved back to Thailand. And And so that sense of you know, right and wrong, really very strong. And Metis Santini very neatly sort of took it right out of the court of right and wrong and said, well, you know, try not to be thinking in those terms, because that's not particularly useful from a Buddhist perspective. Look at it from the perspective of suffering or non-suffering. And that's that, because that's where the whole concept of, say, kusala and akusala is not not just good and bad, right and wrong. It's also woven into it is it conducive to suffering, or is it conducive to freedom from suffering? And that's a whole realm that oftentimes we don't think very much about. We can tend to get caught in the whole realm of things, whether they're right or wrong, whether they're good or bad, and then miss the whole feeling tone of it. You know, is it conducive to suffering or not? Because even if you're right, and we make suffering out of it, you know, what benefit is that? Or even if something you hold tenaciously to what is good, but you make yourself miserable about it, you know, what benefit does that bring? So that the Buddha is always looking more to that. A bigger picture, and saying, because I mean, obviously, you know, good and bad, right and wrong, I mean, that fits into the picture as well, but it isn't the whole picture. And you know, what is more important is to also include that aspect of, well, is it for more suffering, or is it for ending of suffering? You know, what's the result? So that when the Buddha, Buddhist tradition, kind of defines what a wholesome mental state is, a kusala citta, they tend to give characteristics of the wholesome mind as around four different characteristics, and one of them is that it in Pali it's arogya, and literally that means sort of, you know, it's not ill, it's not it's not sick. That rokia is sort of sickness, and that is sort of on the element of it's not fraught with dis-ease, it's not fraught with agitation. It's not fraught with discomfort, so that they say the wholesome citta has this quality of a freedom from dis-ease, a sense of ease, a sense of settledness, a sense of well-being that is not agitated, Another characteristic is the quality of in Pali is anavajja, which means blameless. It's something that is not worthy of blame. It's not worthy. It's not, say, there's not an inherent kind of painful result to it, or sort of it's intrinsically criticized, worthy of criticism. It's not that sort of fundamental goodness. There's not a painful result to it, or, so that is a characteristic that tends to say brightness as well. So when one has established oneself in that which is fundamentally good, then there's a sense of brightness there. And a sense of lack of, there's a certain boldness there in terms of, say, not fearful or timid, because one is turning attention to the good, to that which is wholesome, and then it supports the mind in that quality of brightness and not sort of shaking or quavering. Another characteristic is of the kusala citta is in Pali kosala samputta, which is arising from wisdom, or arising from discernment. So that there's an intrinsic sort of wisdom, intelligence, fundamental clarity of attention that allows the mind to see things a bit more clearly. One is discerning things in their correct way. Because it's so easy for the mind to be swamped with one's biases, one's or the kind of clouded nature of, say, like in a decision, perceptions that we have things that make the mind, we decide, that person is like this and that person is like that and they shouldn't do that. And that's kind of background, even though it sounds righteous, it's not really using discernment. It's coming from an unwholesome mental state. So that the mind can't ever really be bright. So that sense of arising, a wholesome mental state arises from a clear discernment. Say, oh yeah, this is the way things truly are, and this is what is really beneficial. This is what is good. So there's that sense of clarity that is associated with the kusala citta. And the last quality that is usually talked about is sukha vipaka, so that the results in happiness, That's a clear indication of a wholesome mental state, is that it results in happiness. It doesn't result in kind of agitation, misery, depression, confusion. It results in happiness. That is its fundamental nature. So, those are really helpful reminders to sort of be considering in our practice and our cultivation, whether it's in meditation practice or in our engagement with the world around us, taking on duties, whatever. Well, what is it that allows us to maintain the kusala citta, the wholesome mind, the wholesome heart? Because again, as that sense of what we're used to is so often, good and bad, right and wrong. And that's, it is interesting to recognize that even some things that we would maybe label good or right, doesn't make it into a kusala citta. Being having a standard of goodness or rightness that then one starts to apply and either critically assessing oneself or critically assessing others. Again, that makes the mind agitated and clouded. It doesn't make the mind bright or bring it happiness. Or some things which are that the Buddha would say in the opposite are akusala, are unwholesome or unskillful, where we wouldn't normally think of that as saying, well, that's bad or that's wrong, that's evil, like drowsiness or being restless. But those are states of mind that the Buddha is saying, in terms of mental cultivation and what is conditioning the mind in a way that supports the bright, the steady, the happiness of the mind. There needs to be that putting forth of effort in order to energize the mind in a way that kind of drowsy, lassitude, drifting quality of mind, we have to learn how to work with that. Or the mind that we're needing to find skill in working with a mind that is kind of restless or is wavering, even though those are not normally what we would think are sort of evil and bad, but they are in terms of what is going to lead to happiness and freedom from suffering. That's something that we need to develop skill around, and so that learning those frameworks of how the Buddha viewed the nature of the human mind and the human condition, because the Buddha Uh, one of the discourses that that he I sort of encourage saying that this to relinquish the unwholesome, relinquish the akusala. If I thought it was for if you couldn't do it, and it wasn't for your well-being and long-term happiness, I wouldn't encourage you. I wouldn't bother to encourage you to relinquish the unwholesome. But you can relinquish the unwholesome. You can do it, and it is to your long-term benefit. Therefore, I say, relinquish the unwholesome. In the same, he says, develop the wholesome, develop the good, develop the kusala, and develop the skillful. If it was impossible for you to develop the wholesome, and it wasn't for your long-term happiness and well-being, I wouldn't bother to encourage you. But it is for your, you can do it, and it is for your long-term benefit. And therefore, I encourage you: develop the wholesome, develop the good. There's also a discourse where the Buddha talks about the. There's another word that's used that the Buddha uses to talk about that which is wholesome, punya, is meritorious, bringing. And he said that he says punya is another word for happiness. It's something that is this good action which results in something beneficial. It's another word for happiness. It's just not to miss the opportunity to do that which is good, that which is beneficial, that which is punya. So that's it. Says not to look down on, and not to make little of the results of goodness, because that brings long-term happiness for oneself and for others. So even to the extent of, say, for a monastic, it's even just that sharing of the leftovers of what's in your alms bowl after the meal, and giving it to other creatures. With that intention, even that much is something which is beneficial. So that doing of seeing the opportunities for doing that which is wholesome, which is skillful, which is good. Because by its very nature, it uplifts the heart. It brings a sense of well-being. And it's something that we can be doing. And to recognize the nature of the mind that sort of looks around and says, "Well, it's all hopeless. It's all for nothing. What's the point? Why should I bother?" Feeling what that feels like at that moment. So, whoa, that's not a very bright, beautiful mental state. It's just not. It doesn't illuminate one's own mind. It doesn't really motivate one to do that which is very skillful. So that recognition. Oh. Just right there is where I can make a difference. I can change that intention or that perspective. Say, well, how can I bring reflecting on the good. And that's what, say, like in just the whole foundation of Buddhist ethics is around the results of actions, but of course actions all are generated from intentions, volition within the mind, whether it's a skillful, wholesome volition that leads us to skillful action. So that looking after of the mental state, but then recognizing the results of action, whether it's by bodily action or verbal action, seeing that it arises from the mental formations within the mind, and then that just for the usually the when one talks about the logic of Buddhist ethics, it's looking at the results of actions, that when one keeps just the keeping of precepts, you know, why does one bother to keep precepts? And the Buddha said that, well, there's five sort of reasons for doing that. One is when one is established in virtuous action, refrains from that which is unskillful, refrains from that which is out of, say, outside the bounds of the precepts, and is established in virtuous action, then there's it's not for one's, you say, one doesn't create suffering for oneself. One isn't doing anything harmful that is bringing suffering on oneself by taking a life of living creatures or stealing, lying, doing things which are almost immediately bring some sort of unbeneficial result. Say, well, one's not by being established within that, then one is refraining from that which is painful, the suffering, so that one is not creating suffering for oneself. One's not creating suffering for others, not harming others in any way, either by direct action or doing things which are having a, you know, creating division, creating conflict, and then the third reason that the Buddha gives is that it is when one is established in the say virtuous conduct, then this is something that is praised by the wise, and even if sometimes we ourselves don't see the benefit of it, we don't recognize what's the point of that? There might be a doubt there. Is that for real or what? But then one recognizes, well, you know, by the standard of those wise beings who I have respect for, or say within history, those who are intelligent and look on them as wise beings, then one reckon, okay, well, within the boundary of what is praised by the wise, so I mean it's a safe bet. The next one is the action which is is skillful, is wholesome, is grounded in the good, is that which is when one is, say, at one's death, one doesn't have remorse for that. It's quite natural in the human condition that as one is facing death or some very serious illness, life-threatening circumstance, there's things that come up in the mind that one has remorse for, or one recognizes, well, that was really uplifting. That was really good. So that those things which are wholesome or skillful, they don't leave a kind of a ragged edge in the mind that there is sort of remorse for, sense of feeling that one left something undone or done in an inappropriate way. And that is to be peaceful in circumstances that are life-threatening or at the point of death. One, it's rare. Two, it's really a blessing. Blessing for oneself and blessing for people around one. Well, the last criterion that the Buddha gave is that it's something that is when one has established oneself in that which is virtuous, then it bring after death, it is the cause. It is the cause for rebirth in a favorable environment or favorable plane of rebirth. And so, out of those four criterion for an ethical basis, then at least four out of the five are grounded in what you can see for oneself, at least in this lifetime, unless those some people rarely, it's a rare occasion, but some people have recall of past lives. But certainly for the most of us, then that's not within the purview of our knowledge. But anyone takes it on. That's one thing. Out of four to five, only one really has to be taken on faith, and the rest can be investigated. The rest can be considered on experience and really thought through, so that there's a gaining the confidence in that maintaining of what is skillful, what is wholesome, protecting the kusala jitta, because it really does bring bringing things into focus, so that one is able to support the mind, the heart of that is steady, is composed, is bright, is lucid in terms of its attention, able to use discernment, and that brings happiness. These are qualities that we all want. It's actually, and on a certain level, it's really it's essential as human beings to be attentive to that, because that is what makes our life a life worth living. It isn't through the material conveniences of life. It isn't through the possessions that we have. It isn't through even through a lot of the relationships that we have. We spend a lot of time trying to get things, whether it's external things of on the material realm, or whether it's on external in terms of experiences, the experience of having, say, a particular experience in a relationship, or getting close to certain things. If we're not really attentive to the well, what's the fundamental mental state? What's the fundamental quality within the heart? And that's where that nurturing of the kusala citta, the bright mind, the good mind, the good heart. I think that's a word that His Holiness the Dalai Lama uses, is the good heart. And that's a way to think of, how do I do things so that the good heart comes forward? Because it's there within all of us. Either it gets overridden, utter confusion, or misplaced values, or pressure from outside values and from society, but that giving oneself the opportunity to return to that sense of this fundamental goodness, and even as practitioners as meditators or monastics or we can torture ourselves with trying to be, good little Buddhists and forget to make the mind established in well-being and happiness. Trying to be great meditators, worrying about the too many of the intricacies of either the philosophy or the rhetoric of the teachings, and forget that the whole purpose of it is to be free from suffering, and that just to return to the how do we return to nurturing that heart of the kusala citta, the heart of that is bright and established in well-being. How do we doing that in taking that into our daily practice of how we approach meditation? How do we approach? What do we do when we sit down to meditate? Because sometimes we sit down and meditate, and we're already sort of consumed with tension as to what I'm trying to get, what I'm trying to achieve, what I'm trying to make my mind peaceful. And miss the opportunity to establish the kusala citta, which is naturally peaceful. How do we approach any particular activity? The chores that we have, duties that we have. Do we do it just to get it over with and get out of get out of get it out of the way so I can get on to do something else, which is more important, which is more spiritual. And then we're dissatisfied doing that, and then when we finally get to wherever we thought was supposed to be more spiritual, we find that we're discontent with that as well. We end up flip-flopping back and forth. So that, you know, how do we just, you know, doing the dishes, cleaning the toilets, doing the looking after the dusting. Just how, you know, really bringing it. How do we make that? How do we bring that quality of brightness and intention of doing, you know, this is something that's good. This is something that's wholesome. This is something that's skillful. You know, taking delight in it. Or even just, you know, walking from one place to another, walking from down here up to our dwelling places, walking from the house to the car. And bringing attention to that opportunity to establish a fundamental goodness of the heart, because each moment is an opportunity, and we tend to miss them by always looking to the future, looking to something else, looking to comparing, something else has got to be better. And of course it's not out there somewhere. It's not over somewhere else. And sort of in this moment, in this opportunity, with this actual mind. That's like the Buddha. It's interesting, even the way that the Buddha puts it, you know, what is the kusala jitta, you know, one of the definitions is like kusala action, is also the mind that is established in non ill will. Or non-harming is how the Buddha defines, say, in mental states. So it's like the refraining from certain unskillfulness is a skillful action. So that the unskillful can then be the seed for the skillful, the wholesome. And just by actually seeing, that's not so skillful, and refraining from that, in the same way, like refraining from harming. It isn't as if one floats around just, you know, doing good all the time. It's like that, you know, it's that recognition that's. So that the unwholesome, the unskillful, can be the seed for the wholesome, and they can condition it. And the opposite is true as well. So one needs discernment. But that sense of you know, when the Buddha defines what is wholesome, I mean, he's not saying, you know, you're always constantly exuding sort of dripping loving kindness everywhere being completely just spouting wise sort of sayings all the time. It's just being able to refrain from that which is unskillful. Which is tainted with ill will, or tainted with harming or something that's harmful in some way, is to exercise that quality of restraint is already something really wholesome, extraordinarily beneficial. And to actually recognize that, to have that conscious recollection, oh. Because that's where Ajahn Chah, so the remember one time him saying, that, oh, you know, there's, my monastery is getting really, really, you know, this monastery is getting really famous, and people are coming from all over the country to make merit. And they're just wanting, you know, he asked them, oh, what have you, you know, where are you from, what are you doing? He said, oh, we're from such and such a place, and we've come here to make merit. And he says, oh, yeah, for all these people coming from all over the country, they just come to make merit. He says, I haven't met anybody who's come here to relinquish that which is unskillful. He said, everybody is so keen to make merit, but nobody's interested in letting go of that which is unskillful, that which is unwholesome. He said, but yeah, and that's really the core. Are we even ready to do that? Because that's fundamental goodness as well. And that, so I said, say the next full moon, that's it, it's a well-known Buddhist festival, and the part of the remembrance of that is the Buddha gave a particular core teaching on that day, and it really summarizes the whole of the Buddha's teaching. And he starts at Sabbapapasa Karlanang, to relinquish, to not say the non-doing of that which is evil, of all evil. Kusala Supasampada, the bringing to into being of that which is wholesome, kusala. And the Sajitta Pariyotapanang, the purification of the mind. Says this is the teaching of all the Buddhas. And it's interesting, you sort of said, it's not just me as this one Buddha, but all the Buddhas, all those who are fully awakened beings. This is what they teach. That refraining from the unwholesome, the doing of that which is good, purification of the mind. And so that as we practice and train in the Buddha's teachings, recognizing that fundamental simplicity, we tend to complicate the teaching so much and get knotted up in them, and just reckoning, wow, this is an opportunity for really letting go of that which is unskillful, really bringing into being that which is good, and letting the heart be purified. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.
Pandoyam itin sadukuram datamase.